start with, I will introduce her.
Let's open up this meeting of the House Rules Committee. It is Tuesday, June 7th. Sorry, we're a little delayed coming off the floor. Thanks for your patience. We've got several committee administrators because we have several different issues, but we're going to start by opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 987A.
That's mine.
That's yours.
Yeah.
You're our favorite committee administrator, Jim, so we started with you.
Yeah. Heard that before. All right. This is Senate Bill 987A. Senate Bill 987A designates State Highway 126 beginning where highway intersects West 6th and West 7th in Eugene and ending where the highway intersects with Main Street in Springfield. As Officer Chris Kilkennan Memorial Highway directs the Oregon Department of Transportation to place and maintain markers along the highway that indicate its designation has minimal fiscal impact. No statement issued. No revenue impact. There you go.
Very good. Welcome to the Rules Committee. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Phil Barnhart, State Representative, House District 11. I wanted to simply to introduce this bill. I wanted to remind the committee that we're referring to the police officer who was killed in the line of duty on April 22nd of this year on the highway that we're talking about designating in his as his memorial. And the other two of us, I think, are going to give more details about Officer Kilcullen, but I will note that he was a family man, had children living at home, was an extremely active police officer involved in long-term in many aspects of police work, and was one of these people who his fellow officers described as the consummate professional, someone who really understood his business well. He happened to be at the wrong place at the wrong time, on his way home from work, on that highway, at the time that he attempted a traffic stop of someone who was driving erratically. And I think I'll leave it there. And I will note that the bill itself does designate, it does require some signage, it has a minimal fiscal impact, it does not do the kinds of things that we talked about at an earlier designation that we were discussing in Eugene some time ago. So we're not talking about spending a great deal of money, but it is a fitting and appropriate memorial for this very fine police officer. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Welcome, Senator Pazanski.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair and committee members. Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to make a few brief words on Senate Bill 987A. I'll start off with Chris Kilcullen was an officer for about 13 years with EPD. He served in a number of areas. I knew him as one of the prosecutors for Eugene and had the opportunity to watch him in court and worked with him briefly in court, but his last assignment was motors, meaning he was on a motorcycle detail. He took that assignment because he is what people would say a true family man, and he wanted to have more time to spend with his two daughters. And as Representative Barnhart said, on his way home, this was a Friday evening around 4:25 in the evening, on the way back to where he lived, he experienced someone coming up on the side of him driving extremely erratic. Instead of just letting that person go, he felt that that person was a danger to not only himself but all the others that were on the roadway, so he attempted to start a stop with that individual. They got out there on is known as Highway 126 Expressway. Some people refer to it as, let's call it the extension of I-105 into the Springfield area. When he got close to 52nd Street, the traffic was stopped for the intersection for the red light. The individual moved over to the right, and Chris moved up to the side of the vehicle trying to signal the person to just pull over and stop there. Unfortunately, at that time, he did not know that she was actually carrying a gun, and all you can say, it was a shot that if it counted for her life to depend on it, it would never have occurred. But it caught him right above the vest, underneath the arm, and he died almost immediately. As I said, I had the opportunity to work with him in the courts, and he was an individual that was known to be receiving commendations. He's received over 85 commendations in his 13 years that he worked there. And there were times where individuals, after they were found guilty by the court, would actually shake his hand and say thank you and actually tell the court and his department how well of a job he performed in the sense of how he treated them out there in the field. I'll leave you with a couple other stories just to show you how this individual worked. He was known in the community for the areas that he worked. He had some of the more, say, transient individuals that he dealt with on a more frequent basis. One of the individuals was being taken into custody and was going to be transported to jail. Struck up a conversation with him because he knew him from previous contact. It turned out the gentleman had not eaten for some period of time. And Chris went out of his way and actually stopped at a local fast food store, got him some food so he could eat before he actually booked him into jail. So, as you've heard, he has a wife, Christy, two daughters. Katie is sick and was very active in volunteering in the community. He wore his uniform for the Relay for Life, representing the department, but really for himself. But he's in full dress uniform and would do the participation in that race. Worked in installing car seats in the vehicles that where people were coming in and getting free seats for their kids. And he also, after he received his scuba license, would volunteer over the Oregon Coast Aquarium, helping cleaning out their tanks. So he was an individual that was, let's say, very well known in the community, someone that was very well respected. And I'll leave you with a couple of points for history on the part of Eugene and EPD. Chris is the third officer to be killed in the line of duty for his Eugene Police Department. The last one was 1934, with the first one in 1930. At the time of the memorial service for him, there are 450 to 500 first responder vehicles that were involved in the procession. 50 different law enforcement and fire companies were represented from Oregon, 4 federal, 11 out of state, one individual came in from British Columbia. And if you are interested to see how this plays within, I call the family of the of law enforcement, as well as the internal family of motors, there's a video about 11 minutes in length, and it has a lot to say. Thanks.
Representative Hoyle, welcome back.
Thank you, Val Hoyle, represent West Eugene and Junction City. I want to thank you so much. There really isn't a lot to add other than to communicate that on April 27th that our community lost one of its best and brightest officers when he was tragically shot and killed. What this bill does is it names part of Highway 126 after Officer Kilcullen, and this was the stretch of area that was the main part of where his funeral procession was and where he was killed. He was everybody's favorite cop, and my two colleagues have gone into great detail as to why this man should be honored, but our officers, men and women in law enforcement, put their lives on the line every day to protect and serve us. This is a very good bill. I do want to share one thing. At his funeral, over 5,500 people came to Mack Court to honor this man's life, and it was incredibly powerful driving around. There were police officers from all over the state that came in to cover the shifts of the Eugene and local officers so that they could attend this funeral. It was a moving experience. He does leave a wife and two children, and we don't ever want them to forget how much we appreciate the work that he did. This is a good bill, and I hope that we can pass it.
Mr. Co-Chair, if I could add two other things we forgot. Number one is that this bill came from the complete delegation of Lane County. All members of Lane County signed on to this bill. This is not in any way to be deemed a partisan bill. Everyone signed on. And the other thing, Representative Barnhart mentioned the signs. The understanding is that these signs would be ones that would be on the side of the road, one that at the entry point there could be two, there will be two, there possibly could be four of these signs, depending on whether you noticed when you come off I-5 and going east or west onto the roadways there. But these will be very small on the side, blue signs, what I would assume. And I can tell you that before we even got the bill going, there was a very large presence on Facebook looking at ways to honor them, and this is one of the ways. And I do believe, you know, if it actually came to be a cost issue, which I know it's not, but the community has already been chipping in. The agreement has been that if that money wasn't needed for this, it will go to the family. And lastly, the support within the community of Eugene Springfield has been overwhelming. Businesses doing profit days for the family, and I would guesstimate that the family has received probably somewhere in the range of $200,000 or more from these different events.
Great. Questions for these witnesses? Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, not really a question. I just want to thank my colleagues for bringing forward and add my support for this, being from that area as well and attending that funeral. As Representative Hoyle mentioned, it was very moving. And, you know, this is a fitting honor for Chris Kilcullen's ultimate sacrifice, and nothing will compensate for his loss, or no words can really soothe the pain of the family and the community. The police force itself, I think, has really had a tough go around, and I just will say that I have never seen the support, and I was born in Eugene, solidify around that whole community for our police department, and this has really woke up our community as what they do for us. So I urge passing this resolution. Thank you. Senate Bill.
I also just note for Senator Pozanski, you know this is a Senate bill that came over very late, got very appropriately referred to the House Rules Committee. Might be a trend you want to take back to the Senate.
I'm working on
two
it.
Bills that are coming out of the House.
It's called the Express Way.
Express. We appreciate you being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Adam Walsh, do you want to come and testify as well? Is there anyone else who wanted to testify on this bill? You can join Adam at the
committee.
The dais. Welcome.
Co-Chairs Hunt and Olson, members of the committee, my name is Adam Walsh, and I represent the City of Eugene. Pete Kearns, the Chief of Police for the City of Eugene, regrets that he cannot be here today for the hearing of this bill, but does send his gratitude for the hearing. Thank you for the opportunity to present the City of Eugene's support of Senate Bill 987, which would rename a portion of Highway 126, the Eugene-Springfield Highway, between Eugene and Springfield, after fallen Eugene police officer Chris Kilcullen, who died in late April in a tragic and senseless shooting during a traffic stop. Officer Kilcullen, as you have heard, was an exceptional officer. He served on the Special Operations Team, the Traffic Enforcement Unit, and was a longtime member of the Eugene Police Department Crisis Negotiations Team. He earned more than 85 commendations during his 12-year tenure at the Eugene Police Department, and those commendations repeatedly cited Officer Kilcullen's exemplary professional demeanor and positive interactions with the public he served, even under the most stressful of circumstances. While nothing can truly reflect the magnitude of such a loss, renaming the portion of Highway 126 where Officer Kilcullen was killed would help acknowledge and recognize the great sacrifice that he and his family have given. It is a right and appropriate thing to do, and it is the least we can do. Again, thank you for this opportunity. We urge your strong support of the Senate bill, and that concludes my testimony. Thank you.
Any questions for Adam? Great. Thanks very much for being here. We appreciate it. I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 787 and open a work session.
987.
I'm sorry. Thank you. Let's close the public hearing on Senate Bill 987 and open a work session on Senate Bill 987.
Mr. Chair.
Coach Olson.
I move Senate Bill 987A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Coach Olson moves Senate Bill 987A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Seeing none. Amy, please call the roll.
Aye.
Representative Winter?
Aye.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Berger?
Aye.
Representative Freeman?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Co-Chair Olson?
Aye.
Co-Chair Hunt?
Aye. Motion carries, and I believe the officer was a constituent of Representative Barnhart, so he will carry on the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Close the work session on Senate Bill 987, and we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 602.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 602 requires instruction in Oregon studies in grades 6, 7, or 8 for a minimum of 2 semesters. It takes effect July 1, 2012. We have a fiscal statement that has been issued. The bill passed the Senate April 6th with a vote of 27-3.
Great. Thank you for that description. Welcome, distinguished panel.
Co-Chair
Senator Berger, all yours.
Co-Chair Olson, members of the committee. I'm Senator Joanne Berger, and I represent Senate District Number 5, which is on the coast of Oregon. You have before you today Senate Bill 602. The need for this bill came to me after being invited to to speak to classes of Oregon students about government and the democracy and our process and all the wonderful things that we believe in when we come into this building to work. And I found that our students in the Oregon schools that I was invited to knew very, very little about Oregon history or civics or geography. And so that was the creation of this bill. Then I began to find out about what other states did. About 33 states in the United States teach their history. Some of them teach history at the middle school level. Some teach it at the fourth grade, which is what Oregon does. And some teach it both places. What I found about what we're doing now in Oregon and teaching in the fourth grade is that it just depends on the teacher that you get. If you get a transformational teacher and she's very excited about Oregon history, you probably are going to learn a good deal. If you get into the routine of which most schools are in, the teachers are busy, they have a play, or they take 2 weeks of Oregon history, which by the time you are in middle school, you've forgotten most of it. So I believe that we need to teach it at a later age, such as middle school. And I think we should teach it for a full year. I believe that what you learn as you're coming through school inspires you a lot into the things that you do. I imagine that each one of you were inspired at some time about Oregon, and the uniqueness of this state is the reason you are right here doing the work that you do. And so I have other people here with me today to talk to you about their support of Senate Bill 602, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Speaker.
Thank you, Co-Chair Hunt and Co-Chair Olson and the rest of the committee. Representative Arnie Roblin from House District 9 in Coos Bay to Florence. I'm here. Senator Verger had talked about this bill a long time ago. We've had a couple of conversations, and she asked my opinion as a high school principal. Is this going to cost a lot of money? I mean, is there a lot of things that we have to do with respect to this bill? And I said, you know, most people have a pretty big collection of Oregon State history stuff in their libraries and other places, and that the materials that are available are easy to come by. In talking to history teachers, the reality is there's too much history to teach at all. Kind of we all know that. And so you have to pick places to teach the concepts of history, and there is no better place, in my opinion, than using our own state, because kids get engaged in a class because they know the respective places. My kids have all said, because I used to talk about Washington State history as a kid growing up in Washington and having it required in the middle school, I had all these little things that I'd learned about Washington State, peculiar little things. And they always were kind of saddened, actually, because they didn't have that same feeling about Oregon. Each of them had a different experience in fourth grade. My daughter has a big journal she wrote of a person going across the Oregon Trail, and it's kind of neat because that's the writer she is. And so she has that particular perspective pretty well because she really got engaged in it. And my belief is that this is the kind of course in the middle school year that you can truly engage students' understanding and hopefully encourage their parents to take trips around Oregon. They have new ideas. They start to learn about all the different names of our cities. I know that when we have those kind of conversations with my kids about how did Notai get its name or remote Oregon or all those other things, it's always interesting to figure out all these places and how they came into being. I believe the best way for kids to really learn and get engaged in history is doing it in a place with familiar names and where they can go visit and actually see it, taste it, and touch it. And it gives them that real lifelong need to continue an understanding and learning of history. So for me, I believe this is the right thing to do. It's one that shouldn't cost us or our schools a lot of extra resources. We have teachers that are trained that can do this already in our schools. We are already acquiring it in middle school history. So I truly believe that this will help future Oregonians have a much better understanding of their own state, so that when our kids go off to college and have somebody say that they were from Michigan and they know all these little interesting facts and history of their state, we can say the same things, and our kids can say, boy, it was really great to have had that class in 7th, 8th grade that gave me a better understanding of the place that I was raised. So I would encourage you to pass this bill and move it forward. Thank you.
Thank you.
Love the senior center.
Senior Senator. Senator Atkinson. Welcome.
Thank you. For the record, Jason Atkinson, State Senator from Southern Oregon, here in a complete, as are my other three colleagues, a support role to the great Senator Verger. So, I obviously support this bill for a variety of reasons, but I think it is most important that we teach history for the protection, really, of what is Oregon culture. As the speaker was giving his testimony, I quickly jotted down some new examples. So, in case you watched the stunning floor carry on this, I wouldn't use the same examples. But from the last train robbery to Chinese labor camps, water power mills, who was Mr. Whitman, who was the Minthorns as they relate to the Umatillas and to George Fox College, and what does flying whale blubber have to do with Oregon history, I think is a fantastic series of stories that really make Oregon come alive. And I think the genteel lady from Coos County can say it the best. When I was in seventh grade, I was told the story of Fleetwood Lindley, and today I have a degree in history and teach a college course on history and have been infected with it ever since. And it was really because I learned who Fleetwood Lindley was. And I know all of you know who that story is, so I won't bore you. But it is very important that we all know what Oregon history is, Oregon's role in the United States with the direct election of the United States senators, with allowing women the right to vote, with the initiative process, and with the fact of how did Oregon become Oregon with giant railroad interests buying influence at the Oregon legislature. This is all beautiful, beautiful fabric of who we are as people. You can go to any other state of the 49 other states, and you will not find a more independent group of people. You will not find people whose big chunk of Oregon history starts with the Oregon Trail, the kids in Missouri know about, the kids in Iowa know about, the kids in Montana and Idaho know about, but that we, hopefully through Senate Bill 602, will ensure that our own kids know about. So thank you very much. It always excites me to get in the phrase Fleetwood Lindley and exploding whale in the same testimony. And I'm sure some intern somewhere in the Senate side has just won a bet that I would do it again. And with that, Mr. Co-Chairs, I'd be delighted to answer any questions.
Thank you. Senator Bocas, welcome.
Thank you, Co-Chair Hunt, Co-Chair Olson. A lot of times, I'm one of the first people to jump up and down and says that, oh, we've got to look out for these mandates that are coming down the road. And so if you look buried in the bowels of Senate Bill 602, it starts referencing some ORSs, and one ORS talks about Oregon Studies means history, government, geography, economics, and civics of the state of Oregon, and Oregon Studies and instruction in Oregon government shall include municipal, county, tribal, state government, as well as electoral and legislative processes. That's already part of state law. What we're talking about is realigning when we do it so that it is more meaningful. And I think the meaningful part, it's probably the most important thing that comes out of this, is when you do it, as the good speaker said, and when they remember it. Because on your floor and our floor, we have interns and pages, and they get involved in the process. And if you look behind me back here, I'm sure you're going to see about two-thirds lobbyists and about one-third constituents and citizens. And how ironic it is, as soon as we're out of session, we're a five-second hero. The newspaper doesn't have us on the front page, and we start getting calls asking us to repeal Obamacare in Washington, D.C., cut defense spending, and start amending the Endangered Species Act so we can do X, Y, and Z. And you all experience this. All of you have been here more than a session. You know what I'm talking about. And you wonder, okay, they're good enough to call me, but they do not know we're not in Washington, D.C.? And so the history of Oregon and how civics work in Oregon is extremely important. I would point out, and I always love this story, and it's raised on the floor before, is as if Lane County only knew that Joseph Lane ran as the vice president candidacy for the Confederacy, they had changed the name of Lane County. Most people don't know that. And, of course, Baker County, Senator Baker never set foot in Baker County, and the legislature complained even when he was appointed, and they appointed him, by the way, because he had come from California and was only a senator 6 weeks or so before he left and was unfortunately killed in the Civil War. And as the five senior representatives that are sitting in front of me here, that have a little bit, if you go back to the 2005 session and focus there, and when you have a few minutes, when you have a long floor session, which you had today, like I have, you know, on the other side, and you read the 45 pages of Oregon history, as Senator Atkinson pointed out right here, is deja vu. No, we did that in 07. No, that says we did that in 67, 1867. No, we did that in 09. No, we did that in 29. Those who do not study history are doomed to repeat it. And if you want to see repeated legislation, just read the 45 days or the 45 pages right here. It's key in Oregon for the economic welfare of the state in the future that we start consolidating curriculum and we start setting a single standard. If we want citizens to participate and bring us good ideas, like the one-third that's back here, not the lobbyists, then we need to educate them, and we need to educate them at the same level we expect our interns and pages are here in the state, and that's at the level that we have proposed. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Representative Berger.
Yeah, thank you. Senator Berger, thank you for bringing this forward. If I understand what you're really proposing here, is we already in fourth grade do, and I remember it from the fourth grade, but what you're suggesting is that we need to do it a little later when we can do it a little more importantly. Is that the basis of your proposal? Because I'm, of course, concerned while we're teaching about exploding blubber, are they missing the importance of Gettysburg? Or, you know, we only have so much time in a day to talk about the important things that we want them to learn. And I agree that this is important, but I do have concerns that there's only so much, and there's only so much history, as you point out, Senator. And so what I think I'm hearing your proposal basically is, let's be a little more serious about Oregon history and teach it at an age where you can get a little more serious about history.
Yes, I think that what they've done is what they've been said, what they've been told would be fine to do. However, I think it should be a structured course in history, and I think they should understand that we had, I'm sorry today that the two students from McNary High School could not be with you because they testified earlier. They did a 100 student survey, and what they found was that the students at McNary did not know who McNary was. Now, you and I might not know who McNary was. He was the vice presidential candidate with Wendell Willkie, but they go to McNary High School. It is important that we connect what has gone before to what they are today and what is going to come in the future. And I think that because the federal government has emphasized so much on math and science, we actually have just ignored the civics and geography and history of even the national history for quite a long time, and it's beginning to show very seriously in our students.
May I add an answer,
yeah.
Representative Co-Chair and Representative Co-Chair?
Co-Vice Chair.
To understand the history of Oregon is to understand the history of the United States. Because Oregon history, if you look at Thomas Jefferson, the only name in the Oregon Senate chamber not to have visited the United States, you have to understand the Louisiana Purchase. To understand the Whig Party and who the Whigs were, has to understand who Abraham Lincoln was, who was nearly our first governor. To understand who Abraham Lincoln was and not choosing to come to Oregon as our first governor, you have to understand why our motto was changed to the Union. To understand why we were changed to the Union, you have to understand the importance of the railroads. And it goes all the way through. And I think, you know, the McNary example is a fantastic example. There were three Oregonians who were nearly president or could have been president of the United States so far. And one of them was president of the United States, someone who's lived in Oregon, whose initials are scratched above Boone's treasury. Hardly anybody knows that. It's a tragedy to me.
I don't consider that a tragedy, but that's another discussion. One other point I want to make, okay? And that was your opening one, Senator, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Transformational teachers. I don't care what you're teaching or what the students are trying to learn. Transformational teachers will get you there every time. And that is my main goal here. Because you can talk about anything, and without the teacher who can transform that student's thinking, you're nowhere.
Co-Chair, Representative Berger, I couldn't agree with you more. And I look back on my own life, and I bet every one of you do too, and I can point out a couple of teachers that made quite a difference in my life. So
thank you for bringing this, and thank you for the discussion, and we'll talk about Hoover and his.
Thank you all. We appreciate you being here. Thanks for bringing us forward, Senator Berger.
You should have this here sometime.
Yes. Yeah, we have five more folks who have signed up, and maybe another member or two who are coming. Let's invite up Jeffrey Stuckert, Beverly Daggett, Julia Johnson.
Excuse me.
Jeffrey, please proceed.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Olson, Co-Chair Hunt, members of the committee, good afternoon, and thank you for allowing me to address the committee today. My name is Jeff Stuckert, and I am licensed to teach high school and middle school social studies. I've also been elected by the members of the Oregon Council for the Social Studies to represent them on the board of the OCSS, which is the statewide organization of social studies teachers. As an OCSS board member, I am the co-author of the OCSS policy statement, which I submitted, opposing Senate Bill 602. I am here today to ask the members of this committee not to pass this bill, which would mandate a full year of Oregon studies in middle school. Rather, I would ask the legislature to work with educators to craft a better approach for ensuring that Oregon studies are taught in our schools. Members of this committee are all too familiar with the desperate financial condition our schools are facing. In addition to teacher layoffs and larger class sizes next year, Senate Bill 602 would add what amounts to an unfunded mandate on our districts and teachers across the state. To quote from the OCSS policy statement on the Senate bill, effective education of Oregon studies, including geography, civics, economics, history, and other relevant topics, requires that teachers have access to pursue excellent professional development in order to be fully prepared to implement high-quality curriculum. It is imperative for education policymakers to recognize the immense dedication of time and resources necessary to properly prepare and teach any new curriculum, including Oregon Studies. As such, the Oregon Council for the Social Studies position is that any curricular mandate include adequate funding for professional development support. The Legislative Fiscal Office analysis of this bill cites, and I quote, the uncertainty regarding the availability of appropriate Oregon Studies materials for the middle school level. As a teacher who recently created two brand new 8-week curriculum units, one in economics and one in U.S. government, I can attest personally to the time and preparation it takes to create new curriculum from scratch. I would routinely need 2 to 3 hours of planning time for each hour of classroom instruction, and that was for two subjects for which there are existing high-quality curriculum materials available. Instead of adopting this legislation as it is currently written, I ask the members of this committee to instead work with classroom teachers to develop an Oregon Studies proposal that also includes adequate resources for classroom educators to create a high-quality curriculum for our students. Thank you for your time. thank you for allowing me to address the committee today.
Thank you. Appreciate being here. Please proceed.
Thank you, Co-Chair Hunt, Co-Chair Olson, committee members. My name is Beverly Daggett, and I teach at Portland Public Schools. And for the last 5 years, I've been working in the curriculum department supporting social studies teachers. And in that role, I have been currently a member of the ODE Social Studies Standards Panel, which is how I learned about this bill and that it had passed through the Senate. And I thought, as a social studies teacher, what a good idea to suggest to teachers that they might want to bring this up in their classroom as a way of modeling civic engagement and as a way of modeling understanding the importance of what goes on in the Oregon legislature. So I created a web page where teachers could go and read the bill and then respond to a prompt, which was, is this bill a good idea? And please explain why or why not, and take the opportunity to discuss this with their students as well. So I have submitted the spreadsheet that resulted from their input. About 100 teachers responded. About half of our social studies teachers in grades 6 through 8 responded to that. And that is, I submitted that spreadsheet for the record, and it's available for your perusal if you're interested. The teachers brought up almost all the points that will be presented by the other members of the Oregon Council for the Social Studies today. But the particular point that was most important to them is, what will this replace? Our teachers of 6th and 7th grade teach world studies. They noted that we already teach a year of Oregon studies in 4th grade, but in addition, we continue to teach about Oregon as we study U.S. history in 8th grade, a point brought up previously by the previous people who were presenting in a few different examples, Manifest Destiny and so forth, all part of U.S. history, where Oregon again comes up. And also in high school history, where students have a little more critical thinking and can think about things at a higher level. Our teachers were most concerned because we live in an increasingly interdependent global environment that impacts Oregonians and all Americans. Most teachers focused on the idea that we need more, not less, of the world studies that we would have to give up if this bill passes. The following quotes are from Curriculum 21, a book about 21st century education, Essential Education for a Changing World. And these quotes express the thinking of the teachers quite well. Your first bullet point, the world in which today's students will graduate is fundamentally different from the world in which we grew up. A 2007 report from the National Academy of Sciences warns the pervasive lack of knowledge of foreign cultures and languages threatens the security of the United States as well as its ability to compete in the global marketplace and produce an informed citizenry. Finally, global competence or global literacy is generally agreed to include these elements: knowledge of other world cultures, regions, economies, and global issues, skills to communicate in languages other than English, to work in cross-cultural teams, and to assess information from different sources around the world, and values of respect for other cultures and the disposition to engage responsibly as an actor in the global context. So as not to lose a full year of world studies, I and the teachers in Portland Public Schools who responded to the survey hope that you will consider taking a different approach to the basic idea of Senate Bill 602 and that you will continue to include educators in the process. Thank you.
Thank you. Julia, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for allowing me to address the committee today. My name is Julia Johnson, and I'm a consulting teacher for the Douglas Education Service District in Roseburg in Southern Oregon, where I bring American history professional development to K-12 social studies teachers through a federal Teaching American History grant. I'm also a board member of the Oregon Council for the Social Studies, and I'm here today to ask the members of this committee not to pass this bill, which would mandate a full year of Oregon studies in middle school, and instead table the bill until further consideration of the current curriculum climate. I was also a member of the Social Sciences Content and Assessment Panel for the last 2 years. I was part of a process that revised history standards to emphasize skills versus content. That was a large part of the previous Oregon State standards. Our new core standards, which have not yet been adopted, are, number one, to analyze and apply cause and effect relationships to a variety of historical issues, events, and problems. Number two, to analyze and apply change in community relationships to a variety of historical issues, events, and problems. Number three, to construct, support, and refute interpretations of history using political, social, economic, and cultural perspective by drawing from a variety of primary and secondary sources. And finally, number four, to interpret historical perspectives through personal, local, state, tribal, national, and global narratives. These standards allow teachers to use their own experience, knowledge, and expertise to teach the topics that they feel are important and relevant to students today. It is imperative to let these teachers make the decision of what American history content to prioritize and the time in which to teach the material. These new standards need to be taken into consideration before enacting further legislation on middle school teachers. I'd like to read a statement from Ruth Kaiser, one of my teachers in my program. She's an 8th grade social studies teacher at Jolene Middle School, Joseph Lane, and his house is in Roseburg, not Lane County, and she's been there for almost 30 years. She says, "This is a well-intentioned and poorly thought-out idea. At the middle school, we are bound to teach to the state standards. There is no room in the curriculum for two semesters focused solely on Oregon. Oregon history is taught in the 4th grade, an appropriate time as students at this age are not yet ready to comprehend parts of the country and world distant from their borders. They are more interested in the local and the familiar. The same is not true by middle school. It is essential for these future citizens of the nation and the world to be firmly grounded in an understanding of geography, economics, governments of all types, world history, and U.S. history. Those are the focus at middle school. Which of these would the Senate suggest we sacrifice? I can say that I teach elements of Oregon history every year as a component of U.S. history, as I'm sure every other 8th grade teacher does. Two semesters would require that students leave middle school with no context in which to place Oregon. This is a dangerous and a terrible idea. Thank you for your time and for your interest in improving education and for allowing me to address the committee today."
Thank you. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm hearing obviously a recurrent theme that somehow or another this bill is intended to block out time to be used exclusively somehow for Oregon studies. That may in fact have been the proponent's intent, I don't know. It also sounds to me as though what you might suggest would be that Oregon studies be woven into other parts of the curriculum. I mean, you didn't actually say that, but that's what I think I'm hearing. You're, of course, are focused on social studies, but you also mentioned geography and economics. Well, economics, of course, is one of the social studies. Geography and geology are not, I think. I'm aware, Mr. Chair, and to the witnesses, about the value, I think, of looking at the local area for inspiration, for studying all kinds of things. When I was in the 8th grade, my father took me to an aerial geology course that met one evening a week, and we saw some fantastic pictures of Oregon geology presented by a University of Oregon professor in that subject. It was fascinating, and it's 50 years ago, and I remember it very well today. And I learned a fair number of the concepts about geology, how land formations are formed, and, of course, gained a huge appreciation for our local landscape, the part you can see even from the freeway or certainly from the mountains or the coast. I'm not ready to judge the bill, but I certainly can see the point that you're making about this idea that somehow or another Oregon can be studied in isolation. But let me ask the question I'm trying to aim toward. If Oregon became a focus, one of many foci for the study of all the subjects that you've mentioned, as a way both of illustrating the point and of enlivening the discussion or the study, would that be an appropriate approach to the subjects that you're trying to cram into this very precious little bit of time that you have with middle school students.
So, I'm sorry, Co-Chairs Representative Barnhart. I would say that some of our additional speakers will be addressing some of the points you raised. The points, or the point that I would make on behalf of the OCSS is that best practices would support teaching Oregon studies throughout the K through 12 curriculum. And when you put it into, mandate it into a specific, into a year of study, what will happen in practice is that it will disappear from every other place. And so when you're talking about the discrimination against African Americans that was written into our state's constitution, or internment, subjects that are probably best addressed in high school and not in middle school, and certainly not in elementary school, that our concern is that as the social studies standards are being rewritten this very year, that we would like to see Oregon history, Oregon studies, geography, etc., woven throughout the K through 12 curriculum and not focused into a single place.
Thank you.
Any further questions for these witnesses?
I would also like to point out that, for example, in Douglas County, we have the Douglas County Museum, which is a very large, very nice museum, and they play a large role working with the teachers to bring Oregon history into the classroom. And so these other aspects of where students can learn Oregon history are frequent, they're out there, and they just need to be utilized.
Okay. Thank you very much. We appreciate all three of you being here. I think the last two folks we have signed up are Sean, I think it's Sean Doley.
Daly.
It is Daly, okay. And Phil Lang. Come up as well. We'll end with a pro and a con. That's all right. Space for all on the Rules Committee. Sean, go ahead. Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chairman Hunt, Chairman Olson, and esteemed members of the committee. I very much appreciate the opportunity to speak today. To speak to Representative Barnhart really quickly, geography is considered part of the social studies, but geology to this date is not. My name is Sean Daly, and I'm the President-elect of the Oregon Council for Social Studies, and along with the Oregon Geographic Alliance, I represent both organizations today. I'm presently a professor of education at Concordia University in Portland, and also served as a secondary school social studies teacher at Gresham High School and at Jesuit High School. I'm also co-author of the OCSS policy statement opposing Senate Bill 602. Before I begin stating why I oppose this bill, I want to note that I appreciate the mentality behind this bill. Oregon students do need to understand key elements of their own state's history, geography, and culture, and I can attest that when 11th and 12th graders reached my classroom, there were areas where students simply did not know important information about our state. To that end, I speak for all of our members when I say that we sincerely are grateful that legislators have recognized the need for greater social studies education. However, at the same time, I'm very concerned by a number of elements of this particular piece of legislation.
And we do have your testimony, so if you could feel free to summarize, that would be great.
I'd be happy. The first issue is I do believe that, as my friends have said, we believe it'd be better off if social studies was taught, especially Oregon studies, throughout the K-12 spectrum. One thing that we're concerned about is that elementary schools right now are seeing less and less social studies every year. A study that was done by Dr. Jeff Pass at Towson State University and the National Council for Social Studies has estimated that elementary students in this country are receiving an average of 14 minutes per week of social studies education. Our fourth grade curriculum on Oregon studies is one of the few places where our kids have dedicated historical and geographical content. If that is moved to seventh grade, then because of the realities of testing for English and math, I can imagine that principals would ask their teachers to not teach that material in order to move it up to where it is particularly taught. The same thing, as a former high school teacher, I'm concerned about what would happen with certain topics if this was taught exclusively in seventh grade. Does the author truly believe that in a seventh grade classroom that you would talk about Japanese internment? Do you believe that kids in sixth grade would understand the implications of Wayne Moore's voting against the Gulf of Tonkin resolution? Okay, developmentally, as an educator, I feel that's inappropriate to assume. And having taught those particular pieces in high school, I know that kids are ready for them then, and they're appropriate because of what else is taught at that particular time. I'm also concerned because if you say that people can still freely talk about them anyway, I'm not sure where, because my former district just cut 8 days from its calendar. There isn't extra time available in the course of a year to add extra Oregon studies if they're going to be taking over the displaced curriculum from a 6th or 7th grade class that will take Oregon studies. One other quick concern, and I'll wrap up, is from an educational university standpoint. I teach people who are going to be history teachers. Nothing in the presentation of this bill follows along with research about historical thinking, critical thinking, etc. The original effort to go and have a quiz of various students on what I would categorize as important but in some aspects trivial information about our state, the explosion of a whale on the beach, okay, that is not where socialized education has gone. We are trying to train kids to be civically minded, to be thoughtful about the legislative process. Okay, and if we are going back to an 8th grade class that's about dates and names, you are relegating history to a way that was taught that was not effective when most people were in school. Okay, the research shows that this is not the way that we want to go. What we encourage you to do is to table this bill. We don't want it necessarily to be killed. We want to work with the authors to craft this bill in a way that our members who are wholly in opposition can come back and support, so that a year from now we can sit here and unequivocally say that we believe in this bill and will work to implement it in schools. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chief Chairman,
you get the last word.
My name is Phil Lang, and I'm here as just a citizen of the state of Oregon, former legislator, former Speaker of the House. This issue was brought to my attention at the beginning of this session by Senator Verger, and I was a little amazed that there were actually some of the schools and school districts throughout Oregon that weren't devoting much time to the study of Oregon history. As long ago as when I was in grade school, we spent half the eighth grade studying Oregon. In fact, I didn't bring it with me today, but at the Senate hearing I brought it with me. I still have the textbook that we used at that time. And, you know, I'm sort of appalled at the opposition, but I think that maybe they need to be a little more open-minded about what Senator Verger is trying to accomplish. And I, there must be some misunderstandings, I think, between the two sides that have been expressed here this morning, or this afternoon, pardon me. I'm a fourth-generation Oregonian. I've been lucky to live in Oregon all my life, and I'm convinced that the half-year that we spent in the eighth grade as I was growing up contributed substantially to my interest in the state of Oregon, but into the legislative process and the responsibility that we have as citizens to participate in the affairs of the state of Oregon. I think it's a good bill, and I would urge that you support it.
Questions for either of these witnesses? Representative Holby.
Thank you. I'm just curious, not for Mr. Lang, but for your name already.
Haley.
I had a short memory for some reason. How would you see this bill being transformed to where teachers could, or the opponents of the bill would be on board and think it was a great bill? Can you just tell me just briefly what would need to happen to this bill?
There are probably three elements I think that would work for us. Number one is that we would like to see Oregon studies taught along the curriculum. We believe, and I represent elementary teachers who think
that Oregon City shouldn't be removed from fourth grade because those are foundational building blocks to understand further parts of it. It belongs in seventh grade, but only elements of it do, and other parts belong in a 12th grade classroom. That would be A. B is a cognizance of the fact that this requires a lot of effort on the part of teachers who are already overtaxed in terms of time to develop quality curriculum. If this is passed now and enacted next year, you're asking for teachers who are already dealing with very large classrooms to create poor curriculum. Okay, they could go to the library and find that material, but I'd ask when in the course of the day would they do that? And the final piece here is that we want to work alongside Senator Verger to be able to put into this bill elements that could support it. One thing you'll see in Representative Holvey is that the resources simply aren't there. I heard a random comment about they're in the library. Okay, the Oregon Encyclopedia Online has 5,000 entries yet to be filled. There is no textbook that is appropriate for sixth grade classrooms, and the Oregon Historical Society sent me an email yesterday saying that they are not prepared to produce curriculum for this bill. And I can produce that email if that's required. For this to work, and we want it to work, okay, there are stages of preparation that we believe have to exist that simply the due diligence has not been done. Okay, we are very thankful for this bill and what it brings in terms of emphasizing socialized education. But if you really believe that you want kids to get it and to remember it, seventh grade alone isn't the place.
Thank you. Thank you both. We appreciate you being here. Anyone else? I'm not seeing anyone else to testify on this bill. So we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 602. We appreciate you all being here to testify.
Sophomores a no.
And I think we will go next. We carried, this one should be short, and we carried over from our last hearing. Let's open a public hearing on Senate Bill 24 and invite Autumn Wilburn forward. Victoria.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 24 eliminates alternative methods by which students may satisfy mathematics or English requirements for high school diplomas, declares an emergency effective July 1, 2011.
Welcome back, Autumn. Sorry you had to go sit through that whole long hearing that we never got you last time.
Thank you for rescheduling.
Please proceed.
Co-Chair Hunt, Co-Chair Olson, for the record, Autumn Wilburn, here on behalf of the Department of Education, speak to you about Senate Bill 24, also brought to you by the Department of Education. This bill received unanimous support out of the Senate Education Committee and nearly unanimous support off the Senate floor. So first, just a little bit of background on what this bill does. It removes a confusing provision out of state statute from the state diploma law relating to the awarding of math and English credits for taking the statewide assessment. Most students in Oregon currently take the statewide assessment sometime during their freshman and sophomore year of high school. This is known as the Oregon Assessment of Knowledge and Skills, or short is OAKS. Under current law, if a student passes the state assessment in reading or writing, they would be issued credit for enough credit to satisfy the state graduation requirements for English language arts. And if they passed OAKS in math, they would be issued enough credit for state graduation requirements in math. The Department of Education also has an administrative rule that deals with this. It addresses the original intent of this section of law and contains provisions for school districts to award credit for student proficiency in a variety of areas, not just math and English. The OAR includes specific guidelines to help ensure that the awarding of such credit is done in a thoughtful manner and requires districts to outline their procedures and policy. This overlap of statute and OAR has created confusion in some school districts, and that confusion has resulted in phone calls to the department, and so we have brought forward Senate Bill 24 to remove the requirement from state statute that students receive their diploma or are awarded credit for passing the OAKS. Removing the statutory requirement and relying upon the OAR instead would result in clearer guidance for school districts and would allow ODE staff to spend more time on helping districts implement this OAR that addresses the issue in a more effective way. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Any questions for Autumn? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I understand that your testimony. Could you give us the statutory authority for the OARs that you refer to?
Snatching defeat from the jaws of victory.
ORS 329.451 is where this was amended, Representative Barnhart.
And if we take this, if I may, Mr. Chair,
please,
if we take out the language that the bill proposes removing, what is the statutory authority then for the OARs that you've described?
Co-Chair Hunt, Representative Barnhart, that is an excellent question.
I just want to dot the I's and cross the T's.
Absolutely.
If I may, Mr. Chair, the subsection 2 on line 19, I think I've got that right, requires a certain number of credits in math and credits in English. And then subsection 3, which we're talking about removing, says that you can do it in a different way. And I wonder if that isn't the foundation for the OARs that you're referring to. If it's not, then there must be something else, either in this statute or some other statute, that gives the authority to the department to ignore subsection 2.
Let me suggest, if it's okay with you, Representative Barnhart, and I'm Victoria, that we will close the public hearing, give them a chance to kibitz, and come back still this
Thank
afternoon
you.
If you can
Thank
find
you.
An answer to that. Okay. I'm getting three
Yes, nods. Mr. Chair, okay. I think that's very appropriate. I appreciate it.
Any other questions beyond that one for Autumn while we've got her up here? Okay. Thank you, Autumn. Anyone else to testify on Senate Bill 24? Great. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 24 and hope to come back still this afternoon. So if you guys can kibitz, that would be great. Let's open a work session on House Bill 2256A. Mr. Stembridge.
Mr. Chairman, this is House Bill 2256A. It actually came off the floor this morning. It authorizes complaints regarding alleged violations of election law to be filed electronically. It does a number of other things that the Secretary of State put together regarding election law. It has no fiscal impact. On page 5 of the bill, down at the bottom, you'll see Section 8 there, which deletes a provision that says the county clerk shall destroy all unused absentee and regular ballots in the county clerk's possession. The dash A version of the bill, which you passed out last week, contains that deletion. You have the dash A6 amendment, which restores that provision. It restores the provision that requires destruction of unused ballots. It also, the dash A6 also deletes another section that has a provision requiring that county election post-election security plan address the security of and accounting for the unused ballots. So what the dash A6 does is take the statutes back to the way they were before with regard to the handling of ballots after the election, after 8 o'clock in the election.
Thank you. Steve, you want to speak briefly to this?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Just to the amendment, obviously.
Members of the committee, Steve Trout, State Election Director, and I appreciate the speed of Ledge Council and the people working behind the scenes to come up with these amendments so quickly here today. So with respect to the A6 amendments, as Mr. Stembridge said, this just returns the bill to the current state of the law as it is today. Those two sections, both Section 5 and 8, were sections that we had added to address some cleanup issues. We recognize the concern that has been raised, and so this will just take us back and want to make sure that we get on the record that, with this, the current state of the law as it exists today is what will go forward, and then we can work with those of you that are interested over the interim to try and come up with some solutions to address some of the concerns that are out there.
Thank you, Representative Weir.
Just for the record, I appreciate the Secretary of State's willingness to take a pause while we work through these issues, and we pledged to work in the interim to come back with a solution to this in February. I've already asked Representative Garrett if he would work with us on that interim work group on this, and so my staff's going to get that scheduled, and we'll get it all worked out, and hopefully likely we will come back with something in February that will solve this before we end up in before we get into the election season when it would really matter. So we have the time to do it. So,
any further questions? Okay. Steve, thanks. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Barnhart.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to understand what the amendment does. The amendment says that on page 5 and 6 it deletes the last couple of lines of page 5 and the first couple of lines of page 6. What's the effect of that? Does that restore the old language, or does it simply remove everything in that reference? I don't know.
It just restores it.
Good, Jim.
The current bill, House Bill 2256A, you'll see has on page 5, starting on lines 42.
I've answered my own question. 40, I'm sorry. It simply deletes Section 8.
It takes that all out of there. So whatever language that you see, any boldface language now gets deleted from the bill.
Right.
And any language that's in italics and in parentheses, which was proposed for deletion, now is restored, and it's accomplishing that by taking that whole section out so the section just stays the way it is.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I apologize. I am tired this afternoon. What it does is it stops amending ORS 254.483. Thank you.
And the same can be said for Section 4.
Yeah.
That there's only one little piece in Section... I'm sorry, it's Section 5.
Yeah.
One little piece in there, and it just restores that to its current status as well.
So, Mr. Chairman, in summary,
yes,
delete Section 5 entirely, which was an addition, delete Section 8, which was a change, and restores current law, or maintains the current state of the law as it stands today.
On those issues?
Yes.
And then the real question, why do we need to do this? What's the problem that we're solving with this amendment?
To garner a majority vote on the committee and in the House.
Ah, it's a constitutional problem. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, I apologize for being slow.
Oh.
Chair.
We are in a work session. Thanks, Steve.
I would move the -A6 amendments.
Representative Weir moves the -A6 amendments to House Bill 2256. Is there further discussion? Is there objection?
It's good.
So ordered.
Chair, no. Moves House Bill 2256 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Winger moves House Bill 2256 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion?
I just want to point out it is 2256A that you were amending. You'll have a 2256B when it gets back to the floor.
Outstanding. Amy, please call the roll.
Aye.
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 Representative
Pierce.
Aye.
Representative
Colby.
Aye.
Co-chair Olson. Aye. Aye. Motion carries. Representative Berger will carry. I would note this is the second day in a row the bill carried by Representative Berger has had to be voted on more than once by this committee.
Mr. Chair.
That was really interesting.
Mr. Chair, I wanted to point out to the committee that as the co-chairs of revenue, it is often my role to point out constitutional problems to my respected co-chair.
And, Mr. Chair, I often am a little slow to picking it up there, too.
I'm going to leave and look at the
administrator's committee. That's great. We will... So we will close the work session on House Bill 2256A and open a public hearing on House Bill 3679. Mr. Smith, you can come on forward. We're a Plan Tag Team Committee Administrator. Welcome, please.
Mr. Chair, committee members. House Bill 3679 is a bill that exempts from competitive bidding requirements those contracts that a contracting agency enters into with an energy service company known as an ESCO in accordance with the adopted rules, or if the energy service company is pre-qualified by the Department of Energy, declares an emergency effective on passage with the provisions becoming effective, operative 91 days after passage.
Okay. Thank you very much. Welcome. Welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chairs. For the record, my name is Jefferson Smith, representing District 47 in the Oregon House. I'll be quick so we can turn it over to the experts, and I'll return to the Ways and Means Subcommittee hearing. The ESCO context, when a contractor goes and makes a deal to do building retrofits, getting paid for by a share of the energy savings generated by the work. Okay. So it's a way to do retrofits without an upfront capital outlay by a, in this context, public entity. In this contracting context, typical contracting rules operate differently because the bid is in many respects the work. If you offer your response to a RFP, and in that response you lay out the strategy about how the energy savings could be provided, that expertise is in fact, so goes the argument, the thing that you are, the value you are adding, not merely the screwing in of the light bulbs, but the figuring out where the light bulbs ought to get screwed in. As a result, the many of the places that could be taking advantage of these things, and many of the companies that could be doing them, aren't taking advantage of them, aren't doing it. Washington State, for instance, having a lot more of these contracts, a lot more of this work done than we are. What this bill does is allow school districts and other local government entities to use that pre-qualification list and that kind of process, the same or similar process that state agencies can already do, to allow to empower the smaller public entities to do that, to choose between an RFP process or a pre-qualification process. The problem was identified and work was done during the session that suggested a new bill. We filed a priority bill a couple weeks ago. The stakeholders have been working on some content issues, and this is a way to help a little bit on retrofits without spending any public money, and a way to help get some contracting work done in relatively short order, we hope. Beyond that, I can take questions if you'd like, but probably better to answer them would be some of the experts on this, so I'm happy to turn it over to if and when the chair pleases.
Great. We do have three folks still coming to testify beyond Representative Smith. Any questions for him? All right.
What is happening back there, by the way? I see the smatterings of laughter that's alternating. I don't know
if it's late in the day.
Yeah, I understand.
I think you're good. We'll invite forward Alex, Steve, and Margie.
All right, back at you. Chair?
Whichever way you prefer.
Member of the committee, my name is Stephen Gaffori. I'm here representing Apollo Solutions Group, which is an energy service company, one of the companies that's mentioned in the bill. I first want to say that the definition, the major summary is inaccurate. The major summary says exempts savings performance contracts from requirements to use competitive bidding process. Actually, that's already the law. They're already in the statutes. Energy savings performance contracts are exempt from competitive bidding. This doesn't change that. The problem is, Mr. Chair, and I've explained this to all members of the committee, and that the process is enormously complex. We asked Mr. Bill Foster from DAS, what is the present law? How can a school district or state agency get an energy savings performance contract, a contract that will allow that agency to get work done at absolutely no cost to the agency? And his response is 11 pages. And on top of that 11 pages is 24 pages left of ORS and rules. Now, if you can imagine a school district in, for example, Oregon City or Salem, Southern Oregon, taking a look at this formidable task of how do they choose somebody to do this project, the answer for most people is, I'll let somebody else figure it out. I've got work to do. I've got leaky roofs I've got to maintain. I've got pipes that are leaking. What this bill does, it makes it clear that those agencies can go directly to this list of pre-qualified contractors that the Department of Energy already has and select someone off that list to do the work. This is the way work is done in federal government law. It's also the way it's done in the state of Washington and lots of other states around the country. Our law, being as complex and slow as it is, keeps energy savings performance contracts from happening here in the state of Oregon. It keeps Oregonians from working. It keeps energy from being saved. I'm sure there is no opposition to this bill. We testified once in front of Representative Holby's committee. No one came to testify against it. It's a bill that makes sense. It's a win-win bill for everyone around. And I would hope that you would not only listen to this bill carefully today, ask some questions so you understand it, because the whole concept is a little complex. The bill is very simple. The concept is a little complex. And set it up for a work session. I know a lot of people are interested, for example, in the Cool Schools project that the governor is working on right now. If you look at the money that's available for Cool Schools projects, a lot of that money is already there and hasn't been spent. It's been there for a number of years. Why hasn't it been spent? One of the reasons it hasn't been spent is the selection process for getting the process going in the first place to hire somebody to do the work is so complex. This takes care of that project, that problem. And we think that if you want the Cool Schools project to work, if you want to have people hired all around the state of Oregon retrofitting their schools, this bill needs to pass. Not just have a hearing, Mr. Chair, but need to have a work session. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Co-Chair Hunt, Co-Chair Olson, I'm Alex Banks, the Director of Apollo Solutions Group. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak with you today. As Mr. Kifori stated, energy savings performance contracts are a vehicle for self-funding projects. Money is already being spent just inefficiently on utilities, and we take that money and we redirect it into improvements in the public facilities or private facilities that need to happen anyway. That preserves additional capital for those organizations, allows them to focus on their missions to support other operations within their schools or their government agency. Energy savings performance contracting is, as Mr. Kifori indicated, very proven within the federal government, many states around the country, and particularly in the state of Washington. The state of Washington has a process that we're simply trying to largely mirror here that has done approximately 10 times the volume of energy savings performance contracts. They've put together grant and incentive programs similar to that of Cool Schools, and they are exhausted immediately because of the ability for, say, a small rural school district that does not necessarily have the legal capability or time or resources to go through a complex, intimidating procurement process to simply rely on the Department of Energy's list of pre-qualified energy service companies and then move forward with the negotiation of a project. And to get on that pre-qualification, it is a competitive process. It's everything from previous experience to capabilities to audits of your financial conditions of your company, so that you can know that at the end of this project, one key element is that the savings is guaranteed. In other words, I write a check for the difference. If I tell you I'm going to save you $100,000 and I only save you $50,000, I write you a check for $50,000. So it's very important that we have organizations that are fiscally sound involved. That's part of the selection process that already takes place. There's a lot of work that's done there. State of Washington has proven the ability to leverage that one step into multiple municipalities and agencies. We have it here, but it's so convoluted, as is proven by the lack of its adoption, that it's not implemented. And as a result, we have situations like, you know, old Senate Bill 1149 dollars that still aren't spent because it's a convoluted process. So I hope that we're able to move this forward and to clear up the confusion around how to implement performance contracts. I want to see it for the state, for my children that go to Portland Public School. I've been doing this for about 18 years for the pleasure of combining engineering degree with a master's in business. I see the economics, the technical. It's a proven model, and it's the right way to go for the state.
Thank you.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to testify. I represent the Northwest Energy Efficiency Council, which is the trade association made up...
Margie, can you say your name, please?
My name is Margie Hoffman, and I represent the Northwest Energy Efficiency Council, which represents architects, engineers, and a lot of people who work in the energy efficiency sector in the state of Oregon. I'm here to testify in support of the bill. There is one language piece that we're still trying to work out. But again, there are two ways that that state agencies can do ESCO work. One is to draw from the pre-qualification list, and the other is to do a mini RFP to have a competitive bid process if they so choose. This bill simply says that state agencies or any public contracting agency, so municipal government, local government, school district, county, fire districts, whoever wants to do the ESCO work that is a public entity in the state of Oregon, would have access to that same process. So they would be able to either draw from the pre-qual list or draw or have a mini RFP process. That's all this bill does. Pages 2, 3, and 4 are simple language changes that Legislative Council wanted to make to the statute. So I urge you to support the bill, and thank you for your time.
Thank you. Any questions for these three? Representative Barnhart?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just so I understand, the guts of the bill are on page 1, lines 18 through 22.
Co-chairs, Representative Barnhart, that is correct.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Seeing no other questions, we appreciate you all being here. Thanks for bringing this forward. That for today is only scheduled for a public hearing, so we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3679 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3687. The tag team continues.
Co-chairs, for the record, Beth Herzog, committee staff. House Bill 3687 amends the definition of solid waste to exclude woody biomass that is combusted as a fuel by a facility that has obtained an air quality permit. It establishes that the solid waste management definitions do not apply to wood residue that is a byproduct of manufacturing wood products or processing wood at a facility that manufactures wood products, including but not limited to sawmills, pulp mills, or paper mills. Given that it is not commingled with solid waste, is combusted as a fuel by a facility that has obtained an air quality permit and is purchased from a facility for fair market value. There's a dash one amendment that you should have in your packets or that will be passed out. The dash one amendment makes some language changes. In addition to that, the major difference that you're going to see is that it establishes that the definitions do not apply to wood residue that is combusted as a fuel by the generator of the wood residue in a facility that has obtained an air quality permit and is owned or operated by the generator or is purchased from or exchanged by generator of wood residue for fair market value and is combusted as fuel in the facility.
Am I correct, since we're just getting these handed out, am I correct we should really just focus our attention on the bottom of page 4 and page 5, right?
Yes, sir. So I believe the significance in talking to the Legislative Council, there are some language changes that the proponents have requested, but the major difference there is that instead of just the person purchasing the fuel to be able to consume it, the dash one would apply to the person who is kind of the producer that they could use it to burn fuel, and the exemption would apply to them or the person purchasing it.
Okay. So Greg Miller is the only one who signed up to testify, but do Ray or Kristen or Holly?
Yeah.
Greg, I know you signed up to testify. Is there anyone else who'd like to join Greg so he doesn't get lonely up here? Apparently not.
You might have some head nods,
Mr. Chair. Greg, welcome to the Rules Committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, co-chairs Hunt and Olson and members of the committee. I know I did shower.
Thank you.
Anyway, for the record, my name is Greg Miller. I represent the Browser Company, and I'm also providing this public testimony on behalf of OFIC as the chair of their Government Affairs Committee. Four quick points to cover with you. The goal of this legislation now, House Bill 3687, is to clarify in statute that woody biomass and wood residual is not a solid waste for the purposes of combustion in a facility with an approved air permit, as you heard from your staff summary. We are in agreement with the Dash 1 amendments that resolve the stakeholder concerns and meet our aforementioned goal. We're in agreement with a DEQ guidance letter that is accompanying this set of amendments. I believe that was sent to the respective co-chairs' offices that interprets provisions of House Bill 3687 as amended. And so finally, I'd just like to add thank you to the co-chairs and the members of the committee and DEQ staff for sticking with us on this critically important issue for our forest sector. And so to place the order, we're asking that that you move forward and pass the Dash 1 amendments and amend the bill and then on to the floor of the DuPass recommendation. So that completes my testimony and happy to answer questions.
Okay. Representative Bernard.
I'm sorry to keep asking these questions, but what broke the logjam and how is the Dash 1 different from the bill?
Co-chairs, Representative Barnhart, we got to yes on how what is characterized for during the process, and then how it lands over into the solid waste side for the refuse and recycling, the folks and their concerns around ownership of that.
Okay. So you've added a definition, I think, of woody biomass.
That's the co-chairs and Representative Barnhart. That's the same definition that occurs in current statute, and so we had it referenced there, and we have it spelled out in the word for word as the ORS is describes it. So in case there's any changes to the definition, folks would be able to see that and know what anything happens to that definition for woody biomass.
Okay, and if I could follow up, does that include things like Scotch broom, which is an invasive weed that some people want to use for generating electricity?
Co-chairs and Representative Barnhart, I believe it would.
Okay. And then, if I may, Mr. Chair,
you bet.
The last part of this amendment, and I just saw it, just seeing it just for the very first time right now. Does that make changes in Section 3 as well? And if so, what are they?
Co-chairs and Representative Barnhart, yes, it does. From the original bill, it adds the discussion about combustion. It talks about not being commingled with other types of solid waste, so that gets some certainty for the waste haulers. It talks about combusting fuel by a generator of wood residue in a facility that's obtained a permit, and I'll skip that part, and is owned and operated by the generator. That's different than the original bill, and it also gets to sub B, which is of importance to the waste haulers, solid waste haulers, which is purchased from and exchanged by the generator for a residue, for wood residue for fair market value and combustion as a fuel. But it also, in the original bill, deletes a provision in there that we had that was troublesome to them, so we deleted that out.
I think one of the main changes, and the committee administrator, Greg, correct me if I'm wrong, but the addition of the discussion of the term generator, the generator of the wood residue on line 30 of page 5, and then again on page 6, line 3. The term generator. Right. And actually, it's also, generator is also referenced on line 2 on page 6, and then the word or after it. So there are, the words look the same, but when you actually look at them, I don't think there's any reference in the original bill to the word generator.
Right. Correct. And also, co-chairs makes it consistent with the current statute.
When we use the word generator, are we talking about the person who gathered the woody biomass, or are we talking about somebody else?
No, co-chairs, that'd be us.
Okay. Well, I don't believe there's a definition in here of generator. Is there one somewhere else you're referring to?
Co-chairs, Representative Barnhart,
thank
no.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm finished.
Representative Holby.
I'm sort of curious, is there at any point, does woody biomass become a solid waste?
Co-chairs, Representative Holby, I don't believe so. That is not something that we'd process as a wood residual. I think the closest that would come to that would be something like bark off a log as we process the log through the facility. And I think we've just covered that adequately for how it would be treated during the process and post-process.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair?
You bet.
So, I mean, looking at the definition of woody biomass, it's got all these things, needles and leaves and everything else that grows, I think. I mean, at some point, does it ever get to a point where it's rotten and has no market value and then is somehow determined to be solid waste at that point?
Co-chairs and Representative Holby, we would never be hauling that material out of the woods. That would be remaining in the woods as biomass, organic.
Yeah, I understand that, but what if it was already at a plant somewhere or someplace else? Not necessarily in the woods.
Co-chairs, Representative Holby, we would dispose of that through the normal process, and if it would require a landfill, then we would contract with a waste hauler to do so.
And so at that point, the waste hauler would determine it that it's
correct
solid waste, or
that'd be my understanding.
Why don't we, if Greg, if you want to stay here, could we invite Palmer Mason from DEQ up? That may be a good additional resource based on these questions. Welcome. Introduce yourself for the record.
For the record, my name is Palmer Mason. I'm with the Department of Environmental Quality. Co-chair Hunt, co-chair Olson. Representative Holby, I'll try my best to answer your question. I think what you were asking, I would answer it in two parts. If you're talking about the needles, limbs such as that would be like forest slash left on the forest floor after processing the logs, that has never been regulated by DEQ as solid waste, and now under this bill it's clearly exempt. If you're talking about at a sawmill, pulp paper mill, or some other processing facility, the bark or other things that may have come off of that, there have been cases where DEQ has regulated that material as a solid waste depending on how that material was managed. I think typically the forest industry is making use of that so they're not having it sit around so that it rots, it causes water quality problems, anything like that, but that does happen. And as we all know, every industry has mostly good operators, but they're also bad operators that cause problems for the industry and for folks like DEQ. Under this language, if that type of material, that bark, that sawdust, that type of thing, were to be used for combustion, then we're moving closer to this exemption in this bill. So hopefully that answers your question.
Yeah, thank you. I wasn't talking about the stuff that's out in the forest. I was just talking about where it was potentially being stored for as a combustible material, and somebody abandoned it, became a problem, and rots, and it has no use or value to be combusted anymore. At some point, I would think that there'd be some sort of way to declare that as solid waste, so it could be hauled off by the appropriate folks.
If I may, Co-Chair Hunt, I think I can answer that question directly, and that is in our guidance letter that we provided to the two co-chairs. If a operator or owner were collecting this material, bark, sawdust, that type of thing, and they were to leave it sitting around for a long extended period of time, then I think DEQ would ask the question, do you really intend to use it for combustion? And that is referenced in our letter, and we kind of suggested to the industry, both to ORA and to the forest industry, that the starting point might be if within a year of gathering that material you intend to use it, that that would be a reasonable way to go forward. And I think for the sake of the forestry industry, the longer the material sits around, the less value it has as fuel. So they have an incentive to use it, you know, quickly or when it makes sense. But we also understand that there may be exceptions to that and that we need to talk to the industry about, for a given material, what makes sense. But I don't think it's in their interest or in our interest to have material sit for extended periods of time.
Any further?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I assume that it's in this guidance letter and it can't be put into the statute because it takes a judgment call at some point. I would imagine is the issue there, but you know, I'd be interested in seeing the guidance letter, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Mr. Chairs.
Cheers.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
We're going to stand at ease for a few seconds.
It's not, no issue.
Did you already ask if there's anything else you want?
Okay, well, we are back. We're still actually in a public hearing. Is there anyone else who wanted to testify on 3687? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3687 and open a work session on House Bill 3687.
Mr. Chair.
Coach Olson.
I move the Dash 1 amendments into House Bill 3687.
Coach Olson moves the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3687. Is there discussion? Is there objection? I'm not sure why Jim spread it out of the room, but I'm seeing no objection. Incorporate the Dash 1.
Here, let me do that, too.
Well, Jim's own little protests of the Coach Olson.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3687 as amended to the floor with the due pass.
Coach Olson moves House Bill 3687 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would simply note that the bill has raised for me a number of issues involving the air pollution questions. I think that I did receive some materials from the proponents of the bill earlier. I've read them. I think they satisfy those questions. I do note that we haven't heard from any of the people who would normally object based on those kinds of questions, and therefore I'm ready to support the bill.
No news is good news, right?
I interpret it that way, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any further discussion? Seeing none, Amy, please call the roll.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Berger?
Aye.
Representative Freeman?
Excuse.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative
Holby?
Aye.
Representative
Winger? Excuse.
Chair Olson?
Aye.
Chair Hunt?
Aye. Motion carries. And anyone in particular would like to carry this on the floor?
Holby.
You seem to be the most enthusiastic yes, Representative Holby.
He who asked the most questions.
I carry it. Okay. Coach Olson will carry. And we'll close the work session on House Bill 3687. And so we are done for the day. We're going to be...
I'll give them to you in advance.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. So this is... we're going to come back and open a work session on Senate Bill 24. This was the one we had unanswered questions on. This should just take a few moments. No, I think we're...
2, 4, 5. No, we're good.
Okay.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
Autumn Victoria.
Thank you for jumping up and catching me.
Right on cue. So, either of you, we had the pending question that Representative Barnhart had laid out, so jump right in.
Yes. Co-Chair Hunt, Representative Barnhart, thank you for the opportunity to go and learn a little bit more about the State Board of Education's rulemaking authority. So generally, the State Board has rulemaking authority under ORS 326.051, but then specifically as it relates to the diploma, they have rulemaking authority under 329.451, subsection 2, which is not being touched by this bill.
If I may.
Please.
You're referring to the same statute?
Yes.
And where does it, where is it in sub 2 that gives this rulemaking authority? I looked and I didn't see it.
Unfortunately, I do not have the statute specifically in front of me.
Well, it's in the bill.
Subsection 2 of the bill is, subsection 2 of the ORS is not being touched by the bill. It is subsection 3.
Correct. It is being removed.
So subsection 2 would stay.
Exactly. But the subsection 2 doesn't seem to refer to rulemaking. Did I misunderstood it in some way? That was the puzzling thing for me, is that subsection 2 doesn't, as far as, I mean, it sets requirements, but I don't see anything in there that says that you can accept these requirements with rules.
Can I ask, are you talking about subsection 2 of 329.451 or subsection 2 of 326.051?
329.451.
That was what I thought I heard, too.
May I?
Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe in subsection 2, if I'm understanding correctly, we've got under subsection 2, must satisfy the requirements established by the State Board of Education in the school district, and under ORS 326.051 is where the authority to establish the standards for public schools is located.
Ah, so it is in the other statute.
Yes.
Thank you.
Those are the two correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now I think we've dotted the I and crossed the T.
All right.
I appreciate the time.
Perfect. Everybody learned something in the House Rules Committee.
Thank you.
All right. So we are in a work session, and there's still barely five of us here. Do we have a motion?
Well, Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 24 to the House floor with a due pass.
Co-Chair Olson moves Senate Bill 24 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Amy, please call the roll.
Representative Berger?
Aye.
Representative Freeman?
Excused.
Representative
Garrett? Excuse.
Representative Holby?
Aye.
Representative Weir?
Excuse.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Co-Chair Olson?
Aye.
Co-Chair
Hunt? Aye. Motion carries, and actually Representative Gelser had asked to carry this one. So now I will close the work session on Senate Bill 24, and now we are done. We're scheduled again for 2:30 tomorrow. We've got a few bills up. We're scheduled for 2:30 every day this week, but we definitely have a few bills up tomorrow. So we will see all that. We're adjourned.
Oh, my gosh. We're adjourned. Did I hear that?
The bill scheduled for tomorrow may not necessarily...